Well, good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone who is coming here to join us in our panel discussion this morning. I'd like to congratulate each one of you for arriving here so bright and early as well, and on the brink of spring, as we weren't sure what was happening last night. I know that it's just around the corner. Before we start this morning, I'd like to give a special thanks to Jamie Lee Bannon over on our right, our musician, who has eased us into our morning with her wonderful flute music. She's a graduate of Tyndale and is currently working with a grade one class in Mississauga. So Jamie Lee, thank you so much for coming so early this morning. I'd like to call upon Dr. Gary Nelson, who is the president of Tyndale, to come and say a few words of welcome.
We do want to welcome you to, in 10 days, I'm going to be able to say the home of Tyndale University College and Tyndale Seminary. Unfortunately, we're still 2 weeks away from that, although this wing is the home of the Bachelor of Education program and a number of other programs with Tyndale. But in 2 weeks, the sisters have moved into their new place. And in 2 weeks, we take possession as of April 1st. And if you were here on April 2nd, we'd be able to walk you through and show you the amazing possibilities of this new campus for us in the future. We're also thrilled that there's such a great mix of people who are here. This is the first of what we hope are a number of chancellor conversations around the challenges of higher education and theological education in Canada today. I think this is going to prove to be an exciting conversation. When I was considering coming to Tyndale as the president, one of the books that I read was written by an author named David Trick. And as I read that book, it kind of got me excited about thinking about how we might reform and renew and even look at new possibilities of ways that higher education could be delivered. Tyndale is one of two privately funded, publicly accountable universities in the province of Ontario. We offer bachelor's degrees, bachelor of arts degrees in a number of different disciplines, and a bachelor of education degree. We're also a large graduate school of theology with over 50 denominations and 50 different people groups with a number of different programs. We're excited that you could be with us. We wanted to introduce you, ourselves to you if you haven't met us before. We wanted you to have a sense of the excitement that we have about this new campus. And we wanted to invite you to join us in the adventure of these conversations over these next couple of years. What will a university look like in the next 10 years? I've been asked also to give a blessing for the food. Let's pray. With a sense of wonder and with a sense of grace, we come thanking you for this food, for our conversation. Open our minds to new possibilities. Help us to think outside of our boxes. And most of all, grant us imagination so that we might dream. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you, Gary. Well, today's topic, I think, is one of great interest to all of us, and it's a topic that can generate a lot of discussion at multiple levels indeed. But this morning, we've got a wonderful team of panelists who are going to take us through the issues that impact academic reform in Ontario at the post-secondary level. I'm just going to spend the next few minutes to introduce our panelists to you. On my far right and on your left is Keith Cassidy, who is a historian and received his PhD from the University of Toronto. He has taught in a number of universities that include St. Francis Xavier University, McMaster, U of T, and the University of Guelph, and he's had a lot of experience in drafting university policies that are related to faculty as well. He is currently the president and academic dean of Our Lady Seat of Wisdom, which is a liberal arts institution in Barry's Bay. Our next panelist is Craig Cooper, who is a professor of classics, and he received his PhD from the University of British Columbia. He then spent quite a few years working at the University of Winnipeg, where he was so involved, from what I hear, in campus life that he actually joined and was a member of over 33 different committees. So I hope it wasn't all at the same time. However, since 2008, he has been appointed as the Dean for the Faculty of Arts and Science at Nipissing University. We're delighted to have him here. Next, we have David Trick, who is quite well known to all of us in his position as a senior government official and senior administrator. He's received three master's degrees from York University, from Bandaise University, from Harvard, and he received his PhD from University of Toronto as well. He is probably known to many of us as a former assistant deputy minister to post-secondary education in Ontario. He was the first CEO and the vice provost of the University of Guelph-Humber, which he helped to found and has really made quite a success of that institution as well. So he's a specialist in strategy development and has co-authored two books on academic transformation and academic reform, and I encourage you to read those two books to get some very provocative issues on how to transform academic reform. So we're delighted to have him here with us today as our key panelist. And last but not least, we have William Van Wijngarden, who is going to be our moderator this morning. He is a physicist and has received his PhD from Princeton University, after which he spent some time doing research at Yale University. And there, in I think it was quite a few years ago, he joined York University in the Faculty of Science and Engineering in the Physics Department, and he currently serves there also as the Chair of Senate. So I have personally experienced his wonderful leadership skills in leading the Senate meetings with great diplomacy and efficiency, so I felt that he would be a great moderator for us this morning. So I'm going to turn the panel discussion over now to William, who's going to go over the procedure and look after our discussion this morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Can you all hear me okay? Well, when Stephanie called me a few months ago and said we'd like to have this symposium and said 7:30, I assumed that was 7:30 in the evening. It reminded me of my youthful days as an assistant professor. We were organizing a graduate class and schedules were rather difficult. So I thought I would apply some subtle pressure. So I went to the board and drew a table. On the top, I labeled Monday, Tuesday through Friday. And then on the left column, I start at 7:30. And sure enough, 7:30 was the only time that was convenient for everyone. So it was a very productive class. And I think it's an excellent time for Board of Governors, Senate to meet, etc. We'll keep that in mind, Rhonda. Rhonda is my provost. I want to make a reasonably positive impression. Today, we're privileged to have three speakers, who Stephanie very nicely introduced. Each of them are going to be speaking for 15 minutes. Thereafter, we'd like to have a discussion, and your questions are very important, and we look forward for this being a productive occasion for us all. Let's get the ball rolling, and without further ado, I'd like to turn the microphone over to David Trick.
There you go. Thank you very much. Good morning. It really is a privilege to have a chance to speak to this group this morning. Let me first of all thank you, Madam Chancellor, for inviting me. Stephanie and I have known each other for a number of years for various reasons, and I was just delighted when Stephanie, you became chancellor here and had a chance to show your leadership in such a wonderful setting. I also want to thank you, Mr. President, for being one of my most avid readers. When you're a writer, you never know who your readers are until they tell you. And when that happens, it's just a really wonderful experience to get that feedback. So thank you very much, sir. Let me share with you this morning a little bit of the work that I've been doing for a number of years in doing research on higher education. And I particularly want to focus on the institutions I know the best, which are Ontario's public universities. We'll have a chance during the discussion to talk a little bit about what this means for the competitors of Ontario's public universities, including, of course, this one. So let me start here. One of the amazing things about working in higher education is to discover over time how many people have figured out that higher education is really important. It used to be higher education was kind of a backwater that not very many people paid attention to unless you happened to have a son or daughter who was exactly that right age. Over time, governments have discovered that higher education is really important. And it's important for economic reasons. It's one of the very few things governments actually have a handle on to make the economy better than it would otherwise be. You're investing in people. You're investing in innovation. You're also investing in something that has a social return in the sense that people who have higher education are more likely to be engaged in politics, more likely to go out and vote, more likely to volunteer in the community. So there are social returns from higher education as well as economic returns. So governments have figured this out, and so governments are actually taking a much more lively interest in higher education than would have been the case even 10 or 15 years ago. The argument I want to make is that even though government's paying a lot of attention to higher education, many of the concerns that governments have, many of the things that governments want to see come from universities are having a very difficult time. Universities are having a very difficult time making them happen because of the pressures that we put on our universities. We put more pressures on them than they can fully absorb. Three pressures in particular that I would want to highlight here. First of all, the fact that when you're running a university, your costs tend to rise more quickly than your revenues. I'll show you some numbers on that. Happens every year. Second pressure is that so many more students want to go to university than has been the case in the past. So our universities are all much larger than they used to be, and I'll show you some numbers to suggest I think they're going to continue to grow. And then the third pressure is we've suddenly discovered that universities are supposed to be the source of new research, new knowledge, new innovation that will drive the economy. You put those three pressures on a university simultaneously, what's the thing that suffers? I think the thing that's likely to suffer most, and that arguably is suffering most, is actually the quality of undergraduate education. And so that poses risk both for our students and also for our desire to have a well-educated group of young people emerging out into the economy, emerging into our future. We look simply at the cost issue. Costs at a university per student tend to rise, best estimate we've been able to come up with, about 4 to 5% a year. Okay, that's not unusual in the service industry. Revenues at the university, well, in a good year, they tend to rise by about 2% per student per year. That's tuition plus government grants together. And frankly, over the next several years, I think it's much more likely to be about 1% a year because we have a government that has still a $12 billion deficit to fix. So you put those two things together, and that gap between the green line, which is revenues, and the blue line, which is costs, you know, that's the financial gap that every university has to close every year. And so every university goes through its annual budget crisis as it tries to close that gap. Add to that the fact that more students want to come to university. Okay? We sometimes think that the growth of university education was basically a baby boom phenomenon. Well, of course, that's not so. We've added well over 100,000 more students to Ontario's universities in the past decade. And I've tried to do some work to project outward into the future. How many should we be planning for? And you see the best estimate I have in the greater Toronto area, we'll have somewhere between 30,000 and 51,000 more university students in the year 2025 compared to what we had in 2009. And at the high end, you see over on the right-hand side, we might have somewhere between 51,000 and 74,000 more students. The higher end would materialize if more and more students from the GTA actually decide to stay in the GTA to go to university. Almost half of them now go out somewhere else in the province. But if more of them were to decide to stay in the university, not very many more, you end up with as many as 74,000 more spaces that you need. Now, put that in perspective, York University is a little more than 50,000 students. So somehow or other, just in the GTA, we're talking about creating the equivalent of another York University worth of spaces over the next 12, 13, 15 years. Now, why would this focus on the GTA? Partly it's where the population's growing. Okay? You see here the number of 18-year-olds, or number of people 18 to 24 in the population. So that red line is everybody other than the GTA in Ontario. The blue line is the GTA. GTA population actually be quite stable in this age bracket, where it's declining everywhere else. But the participation rate is growing. The share of young people who come out of high school wanting to attend university is growing. That's why you get the larger numbers in future. One reason the share is growing is simply because of our demographic makeup is changing. Statistics Canada did a study a few years ago. What's the chance of a student going on to university based on parents' immigration status? And you see the results here. So the top bar there, mom and dad grew up in China, came to Canada, son or daughter, chance of going to university is about 70%. Mom and dad grew up in India, chance is about 65%. You go way down to where that black arrow is, mom and dad grew up in Canada, the chance is about 28%. Okay? This is why, or one of the principal drivers for why there's so much demand for university education here in the GTA, and it's why I think we need to prepare for it. So, we have financial pressures, we have lots more students wanting to come. How do universities cope? Well, there are three traditional ways that universities have typically used. One is larger class sizes. So we know class sizes are getting larger. Lots of data that suggests that they continue to get larger. Most students are at a university where more than 30% of the first year classes have more than 100 students. So their chance of having a lot of one-on-one contact with individual professors has been reduced. Hiring more part-time faculty. Second way of dealing with it, because part-time faculty work for less expensive per course taught than full-time faculty. Nothing against part-time faculty. I actually teach a course on Wednesday evenings at Ryerson University. I'm happy to tell you part-time faculty can do a great job. But when you have more and more of them, you have to ask what's happening to the university itself. And then the third thing that happens is semester is getting shorter. Just by a week at a time, declaring another reading week, this takes some of the pressure off as well. Those of you who had a chance to look at the books I've helped write know that I've been a proponent of a few things that are a little bit controversial. There are also a few things on this list that I have not been a proponent of. But you see some ways of coping that might be relevant here. One is simply to say we need some new universities, and in particular universities that might focus a little more on teaching and less on research. We ought to look at the length of students' programs. Students have a choice between three-year programs and four-year programs. It's possible that many of the students would be better off with three-year programs that are more focused on what they want to learn. We could look at a bigger role for colleges. Okay? Now, the colleges are by no means empty either. So colleges are quite full, but there might be some opportunities for colleges to take on some of the work that universities are now doing. So programs where a student starts in college and then attends university, or, of course, a number of colleges are offering their own degrees. Some people have been advocates for private education. This has not really been in terms of for-profit private education. This hasn't really been my priority because it's very hard to actually push for-profit education to exist where it doesn't want to exist. But there are rooms for private universities, and I'm sure that's one of the things that we'll talk about later this morning. Last thing on my list here is online universities. Huge potential in terms of online instruction, The question is, how will it get organized? How will it expand? How will students get recognized for doing online education where it does exist? There's a whole question mark over the field of higher education because nobody really knows where higher education is going to go. Last area that we really want to think about here is rethinking the university from within. So it's easy for folks outside the university to say, why don't they do this? Why don't they do that? Why do we need new universities and so on? The fact is, if you're running a university, people have a whole menu of things that they could try, and in fact they are trying, in order to address some of the concerns that I raised in terms of the quality of undergraduate education. So you see some of that menu here. First of all, simply measuring learning. Okay? All those good tests that your kids take if they're in the K-12 system where they try to measure how much a student is learning in high school, we've tended not to do that in universities. And yet if you start to measure learning in universities, you can get yourself away from simply measuring how many hours did a student spend in the classroom, actually focus on how much did they learn during that period. Once you do that, you liberate yourself for how you teach them. Rather than saying, well, we know they got taught because they spent 13 weeks sitting in a classroom for 3 hours a week, you evaluate what you're doing in terms of how much do they know when they started the course, how much do they know when they ended the course, and then let's think about different ways in which we could use that period of time, however long it is. Electronic learning. Okay, I mentioned it as something that might exist in terms of online universities, but the fact is there are all kinds of opportunities within our existing universities to adopt online learning or other forms of electronic learning as a way of strengthening what students learn, also changing the ways in which they learn it. Experiential learning, most of us are familiar with one form of it, which is co-op education. Lots of other forms of it, too. All the critiques that come of students leaving the university without having practical skills, well, in fact, that all of experiential learning is intended to address exactly that issue, trying to make a better bridge between what the student learns in the university and some of the practical experiences the student is going to need in order to function after they leave the university. So all kinds of efforts to expand experiential learning, make it part of many programs, not just the ones that are formally designated as co-op programs. Now, separating learning from credentialing, okay, this makes universities a little bit uneasy, but the idea here is to say students learn a lot of things in their lives in a lot of different settings. Can we give them credit for the learning that they have learned outside of our own university? So this may be formal education that they took elsewhere, say if they started in college for a few years and then transferred to the university. It could be learning that comes from workplace experiences they've already had. It could be learning that they do by learning something online and then saying to the university, I don't need to take your course here because I've already learned that in an online course. Trying to find ways in which our existing universities can recognize students learning from other sources and give them credit towards a credential is one of the bridges we could make that would recognize the reality our students learn from a whole lot of different sources. And then the last thing on my list there, rewarding the faculty. Okay? It's not very hard to find people criticizing faculty members for not doing this, not doing that. The fact of the matter is our faculty, most of the ones I've observed, work extremely hard. And they're under pressure to be great researchers. They're under pressure to be great teachers. They're expected to contribute to the administration of the university. Our faculty have 24 hours in a day like everybody else. And what's remarkable is how many different things they are asked to do and how many of them do those things extremely well under very, very high pressure. So thinking about ways of rewarding them for what they do, making sure the ones who are doing an effective job actually are recognized for doing so, I think needs to be part of this agenda as well. Now, this is sort of a short menu of a much longer list of things that could be done, some of them within the existing universities, some of them requiring changes from outside, driven by government or by other sources. Lots more things that we could talk about here. As a good author, I'm required to put in a plug for my book, so let me, if you haven't got a copy yet, by all means, it's a great gift idea for everyone on your Easter list. Thank you very, very much for your attention here, and I look forward to our conversation together. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, David, for that very enlightening presentation. We'd like to move on right now and move to our next speaker, Dr. Craig Akula.
Thank you, Madam Chancellor, for inviting me here. I'm going to begin with a series of questions as a way to reflect on what David has said. So a very basic question, what is the purpose of universities? Sometimes this question seems to get lost in the clamor to make universities more relevant. Are universities meant to be the drivers of innovation, the engines of the economy, and are they there simply to provide training for employment, employable skills? These last questions are particularly relevant for smaller institutions like Tyndale and Nipissing, which are liberal-based with few professional programs. And all of this discussion about change and transformation, where is the question about the value of liberal education as it is traditionally conceived and expressed at primarily undergraduate institutions? Is there still a place for liberal education, or has its time long passed? And in the face of this drive for credentials, credentialing creep as I call it, is there still time and place for the simple pleasure of exploring ideas, unlocking the mysteries of the university, sort of the university, universe, not the universities? That is something that you'll never unlock. So unlocking the mysteries of the universe, broadening our thinking, or is that now simply an irrelevant pastime? Perhaps we need more differentiation, as David has suggested both today and in his books, and actually I read it when I was in Cuba this in February. That was the book I took along with me. So, and I would tend to agree that we should differentiate, and perhaps in that differentiation, primarily undergraduate institutions like Tyndale and Nipissing can actually thrive. I thought, and this may seem a bit bizarre, but I thought as a way to spark our discussion, I would reference the Yale report of 1828, which is actually modern history for me. And I think it's relevant because Yale is a college, like Tyndale, and had a seminary as well. The report has been described as one of the most influential documents in the history of American higher education. The report was in part prompted by a debate on whether to change the traditional curriculum, the teaching of classical languages, which I thought was appropriate given that I'm a classicist and have often argued for the value of studying dead languages. A discipline like classics has had to reinvent itself to remain relevant or at least keep ahead of the penetrating eye of the dean. But however we have transformed ourselves, we've retained traditional elements like teaching dead languages. The striking thing when you read the Yale report is that little seems to have changed. The same challenges and concerns are voiced today as they were back then. The same debate and the same criticism is directed at universities that they are out of touch with current realities of modern society. So I thought I'd just read a few segments of the Yale report. So what I'm going to quote is written by the president of Yale. It reminds me of something that comes out of COU, but has much better prose. So here I quote, "We are decidedly of the opinion that our present plan of education admits of improvement. We are aware that the system is imperfect, and we cherish the hope that some of its defects may ere long be remedied. We believe that changes may, from time to time, be made with advantage to meet the varying demands of the community, to accommodate the course of instruction to the rapid advance of the country in population, refinement, and opulence." The report goes on. "The guardian of the college appear to have ever acted upon the principle that it ought not to be stationary, but continually advancing. Some alteration has accordingly been proposed almost every year from its first establishment. It is with no small surprise, therefore, we occasionally hear the suggestion that our system is unalterable, that colleges were originally planned in the days of monkish ignorance, and that by being immovably moored to the same station, they serve only to measure the rapid current of improvement, which is passing by them. But perhaps the time has come when we ought to pause and inquire whether it will be sufficient to make a gradual changes as hitherto, and whether the whole system is not rather to be broken up and a better one substituted in its stead from different quarters, We have heard the suggestion that our colleges must be new modeled, that they are not adapted to the spirits and wants of the age, that they will soon be deserted unless they are better accommodated to the business character of the nation. As this point may have an important bearing upon the question immediately before the committee, we would ask their indulgence why we attempt to explain at some length the nature and object of the present plan of education at the college. And so I'll just give you a little bit about what the purpose of a college, as the Yale report suggests. What then is the appropriate object of a college? Is it not necessarily here to determine what it is which in every case entitles an institution to the name of a college? But if we have not greatly misapprehended the design of the patrons and guardians of this college, its object is to lay the foundation of a superior education, and this is to be done at a period of life when a substitute must be provided for parental superintendence. We no longer worry about that. The groundwork of a thorough education must be broad and deep and solid. For a partial or superficial education, the support may be of looser materials and more hastily laid. For two great points to be gained in intellectual culture are the discipline and the furniture of the mind, expanding its powers, storing it with knowledge. The habits of thinking are to be formed by long, continued, and close application. The minds of science must be penetrated far below the surface before they will disclose their treasures. If a dexterous performance of manual operations in many of the mechanical arts requires an apprenticeship with diligent attention for years, much more does training of the powers of the mind demand vigorous and steady and systematic effort. So there's parts of the report. The Yale report is often regarded as reactionary and set back educational reform by some 50 years, both at Yale and other institutions like Harvard. The report was in part, as one scholar notes, a disquisition on the meaning of liberal education and should be understood against the backdrop of rapid economic change and transformation, against what the report itself calls the business character of the nation, and against the backdrop of stirrings of educational reforms at Harvard and elsewhere, and against the progressive curriculum of Jefferson's University of Virginia, which aimed to prepare students for commercial society. All this sounds hauntingly familiar to me. Reformers at Harvard and the University of Vermont, for instance, were seeking reforms that would address the changing times, open up colleges to larger segments of the society, so the 70% post-secondary attainment that the government of Ontario wants, create distinct departments of knowledge and replace the traditional pedagogical method of instruction based on recitation and prescribed classical texts with the new pedagogy of the lecture, discussion, and inquiry. It's hard to imagine that the lecture was new pedagogy. But today, the current predominant pedagogical method of instruction at universities, the lecture, discussion, and inquiry, is being challenged, supplemented, and even supplanted by online learning, blended models of learning, MOOCs, and outcomes over context. How do we respond to this? Should we, like Yale, incorporate both methods of pedagogy? So if you read the report, they do encourage lecturing on top of recitations and so forth. The apprehension about change expressed in the Yale report is sometimes the same apprehension which I've expressed and which many of my faculty express. Many, if not most, would admit the need for improvement. But is incremental change enough? Or is it time for wholesale change, as David suggests, time to new modeled? The interesting thing about the report is its emphasis on mental discipline. Liberal education is no longer spoken of in terms of nurturing moral virtue for the public good, which had long been its expressed aim, so if you read earlier types of documents, but now of nurturing mental discipline that prepares students for the new realities of a commercial society. Graduates of a liberal education, the report suggests, can act and think independently. Critical thinking, we all talk about that stuff. And when faced with a variety of opportunities, can draw on the resources of the mind, to use the language of the report, to succeed. Liberal education has taken on a distinctly utilitarian purpose that prepares the student for any profession. Isn't that the current reality of the 21st century, where graduates can expect several careers over the course of their lifetimes? And how do we best prepare them for the challenges? And that's the question. One need only look at the Drummond Report, which makes a series of recommendations about post-secondary education, among them that the government refocus resources and rewards towards teaching, so the very things David was talking about, and recommends that institutions, and I quote, devote more resources to experiential learning, such as internships, allow for more independent or self-assigned study, develop problem-based learning modules, and increase study abroad and international experiences, end of quote. These are what are called high-impact practices, or HIP, practices which are meant to instill in students deep learning and the ability to think critically, to express their thoughts clearly, and to adapt and apply knowledge to new areas and tasks, again out of the Drummond Report. This is precisely the value of a broad liberal education as advocated in the Yale Report. Little seems to have changed in terms of the rhetoric, and it's the same kind of rhetoric I've used to defend the traditional liberal education at a university like Nipissing. The Yale Report notes that the object of liberal education is not to finish the education, but to lay the foundation and to advance as far as rearing the superstructure he has, at least, I quote, been taught how to learn. The Yale Report asks some important questions, which in one form or another are still asked today. So I'm going to just go back to the report and use that again as a starting point for our discussion. And I quote, "But why, it may be asked, should a student waste his time upon studies which have no immediate connection with his future profession?" I've heard that many times. "Why should not his attention be confined to the subject which is to occupy the labors of his life? In answer to this, it may be observed that there is no science which does not contribute its aid to professional skill. Everything throws light upon everything. The great object of a collegiate education, the report says, is preparatory to the study of a profession, is to give that expansion and balance of mental powers, those liberal and comprehensive views, and those fine proportions of character which are not to be found in him whose ideas are always confined to one particular channel." It goes on to ask, "Is a man to have no other object than to obtain a living by professional pursuits? Has he not duties to perform to his family, to his fellow citizens, to his country, duties which require various and extensive intellectual furniture?" End of quote. To this last question, I would answer a resounding yes. So how are places like Nipissing responding to the forces of change, to our new digital age? So that's the comparator to the commercial age of the 1820s in the U.S. Perhaps not as rapidly as some would like, but here are some examples, and I'll conclude here. College partnerships with Humber, where graduates of the Humber three-year diplomas in IT can complete a Bachelor of Science in Technology in North Bay at Nipissing. MEUs with Georgian and Fleming College, so students can transfer from two- or three-year diplomas into our BFA. An MOU with Tyndale in the areas of biology and mathematics, where students take their first 2 years here studying biology or mathematics and then complete their degrees up at Nipissing. College partnerships, and this is probably more innovative and certainly not coming from my faculty, so that tells you something about me, I guess. College partnerships in our BCom, where graduates of various colleges of a three-year diploma in business, so these are colleges throughout Ontario, can complete a Nipissing degree on-site in their college through a blended learning model. Bridging programs for RPNs, that is a combination of online and on-site programming. And one thing that we are working on now in arts and science is a unique combination of summer residency, online and blended learning to offer arts and science programming to First Nations in the James Bay Area. New modeled? Perhaps, perhaps not. So I'll leave it there.
Well, thank you very much, Craig, and I must say I'm very intrigued by that history of that Yale report. I wonder if you Google this Turnitin, if that will also be referenced. Some of these politicians may be using that unannounced to us. It's now time for our final speaker, Dr. Keith Cassidy.
Well, I appreciate this opportunity to express a series of outrageous views. And I do so, I must say, to my astonishment, I look out and realize I'm doing so under the watchful eye of a former student. So I'm going to have to behave myself here. This conference is entitled The Possibilities for Academic Reform. And I've been asked to provide the perspective of a small private institution. And in the remarks that follow, I do not want to be seen as denigrating the role of large, publicly funded universities. I spent many years in one and can attest that there are certain tasks that are difficult, in fact, impossible outside of a large, well-funded institution. To undertake the study of particle physics, for example, in our institution would be, practically speaking, impossible. I can attest as well to the high quality of many of the faculty at these institutions. It was my privilege for many years to work with excellent researchers and truly dedicated teachers in the history department at the University of Guelph. Nonetheless, it seems to me there are problems, and I would be remiss if I did not make mention of some of them. Small institutions and private institutions provide some possible answers to these issues. And I certainly am not suggesting that the small private institution, the kind of thing I'm speaking of, is the answer to the formidable challenges that Dr. Trick pointed out when you're facing a flood of 50,000 more students in the area, et cetera. What possible relevance can a small private institution have? Well, there may be some things to think about in our experience and the concerns which come out of that. To begin, I am, as you've heard, the president of Our Lady Seat of Wisdom Academy. We're a small, poor, and obscure institution. And in the great scale of things, looked at from the commanding heights of the Mowat Block, where the Ministry of Training, Colleges, and Universities attempts to hold sway over the post-secondary sector of the universities, we are of very little consequence. Perhaps, however, our experience provides some useful lessons. This is our 13th year of operations, and we just have just under 80 students. We are a three-year post-secondary institution with a very strong focus on the liberal arts. Our program is highly prescriptive. There are a number of mandatory courses, particularly in the first year, which is set out with quite great clearness as to what you must take. Because we believe that there are certain things which every educated person should know. And whether that person is going off to become a university professor, as some of our former students have done, or whether that person is going off to become a welder, which some of our students have gone off to do, there are things which we think everyone should know. Remarkably enough as well, we believe that the faculty have a better idea of what constitutes the essentials of a good education than our incoming 18-year-old students. And so we actually quite shamelessly prescribe what they are in fact to take because, yeah, we really do think we know better. And this is, as I said, you can tell this is a contrarian presentation. We are also an unapologetically an Orthodox Roman Catholic institution offering an education from that perspective. We do not yet offer degrees. To do so, we will have to go through the arduous process of review by the Post-Secondary Education Quality Assessment Board, PCAB, well known to many around this room. The credits we do give to our students have been accepted by a number of other institutions as fulfilling part of their degree requirements. But that, of course, is a choice by these institutions. It's not something we advertise that we don't advertise we give university credits. We just give courses and which are of value in themselves. Our alumni have graduated from a number of undergraduate institutions, and many have gone on to do graduate work. The number of them are in quite a range of fields, physiotherapy, and as I said, they're lawyers, they're veterinarians, there's quite a range of people who pass through our program doing a number of other things. One lesson from our experience is that educational excellence does not necessarily involve a huge budget, nor does it necessarily involve modern technology. And I will just in passing mention a book which all of you are, of course, familiar with, which came out a year or so ago, Academically Adrift, pointing to the declining and quite staggeringly bad levels of academic achievement at many American universities, many from students coming out of quite well-funded and technologically very advanced institutions, which did not necessarily produce very well-educated students. So our focus is on the actual educational outcome rather than a focus on what is necessarily expensive. Another lesson from our experience is that students benefit from an environment in which they're deeply valued for their worth as individuals. We are a very small campus. You cannot simply disappear into an anonymity on our campus. This is not an institution of 20 or 30 or 35,000 students around, where you can, in fact, retreat to your dorm room and disappear. If you're flailing around, people will help you. I should also mention that we are a largely residential school, and for us, there is no radical separation of life and learning. We believe that the same values should animate both. Now, this is not everybody's cup of tea, but there are many students who cherish such an environment. And, of course, you will recall the many studies which have appeared, and there was the article which came out in Maclean's last fall discussing mental health problems of students on campuses and the large number of students suffering from depression and for whom university is an extraordinarily stressful environment. I would say, obviously, we have students who come to us with problems. It is a stressful time of life. But they find in our environment of the small institution a degree of support, a degree of acceptance, a degree of understanding, which is not necessarily found in much larger and more impersonal institutions. Being private as well has great advantages. While we do not get public money, we, of course, get to set our own course and our own criteria and our own values. Consider, public universities must not have, cannot have, precisely because they are recipients of public funds and are of necessity not tied to any particular vision, they do not have any underlying vision of man or creation. Indeed, to even mention creation would be contentious because it would imply a creator. And Dawkins would be on your case before you could say boo, because you cannot discuss a university, public university educational program in the context of an explicit unifying core of beliefs. The university is holds itself to be diverse and pluralistic, and I would argue that in consequence really cannot have a coherent curriculum that is coherent in the sense of animated by, as I said, a clear unifying vision of man and creation. Thus, it is possible that at many universities, for students, even students from a BA program, to graduate never having read even one book in common with other graduating students. That kind of point is made as well. I think some of you have read Anthony Cronman's Education's End, Why Our Colleges and Universities Have Given Up on the Meaning of Life, lamenting the fact that universities no longer address large issues of the nature of being. And also what we believe that there really is such a thing as truth. Indeed, our motto is Veritas Vos Liberat, the truth shall set you free. And our curriculum is based on that assumption and the belief that there are core truths which must be learned to live a truly free life. These are shockingly radical things to express in certain contexts. Strikingly, while large public universities often speak of the value they place on diversity, there is in fact very little diversity of thought in many modern universities. A dominant secularism and a pervasive leftist or political orientation means that the concerns and interests of religiously or culturally conservative students are at best ignored or more likely mocked and attacked. While this is not true of all faculties or all departments, it is a fact of life. The students outside that secularist consensus attest, sometimes bitterly, to the narrowness of the education offered. An extraordinary demonstration of this has been the movement at campuses across the country to shut down campus pro-life clubs. This has been turned back in many cases, but only by the threat of legal action. What the willingness of student councils to repress dissenting views speaks volumes about the real love of diversity instilled in them by many of their professors. I notice well the complicity of many university administrations in these repressive measures. The issue of actual diversity as opposed to a kind of measurable diversity of is something which I think is not part of the larger agenda of discussion of post-secondary education in this province, but perhaps ought to be. How truly diverse and welcoming and open are the universities of the province to people whose fundamental viewpoint is religious or culturally conservative? When there is a discussion of the challenges facing public higher education, a discreet veil is often drawn over the gap between the proclaimed tolerance and diversity of institutions and their actual practices. A private institution is able to advance views frozen out from many larger public institutions. When we speak of diversity, we should think not just of diversity within institutions, but among institutions. The independent private college can make an enormous contribution to educational diversity by boldly identifying its own distinctive core convictions and living by them. And these institutions should not merely be grudgingly tolerated by the MTCU, but actively encouraged. A problem with the politically supported institution is that inevitably the state sees them as agents of its will and agenda. And in this regard, I found the discussion paper issued last year by the MTCU very revealing, one you're all, of course, very acquainted with. It's entitled Strengthening Ontario's Centers of Creativity, Innovation, and Knowledge. It contains the assertion that this paper seeks to apply the vision for post-secondary education in Ontario, and emphasis, as articulated by our government, and later goes on to say, as our government begins the process of transforming this sector, a number of stakeholders will be consulted. The assumption is very simply that the agenda of the public of a higher education is in fact a political agenda driven, or a government agenda ultimately driven by political considerations. And institutions, universities, created in many cases by individual effort or by churches, have been in fact conscripted to serve a larger public agenda. Now, this is of course utterly understandable. The government is paying the money, it gets to call the tune. And how are you going to justify spending billions of dollars on higher education if you can't demonstrate to the taxpayer that they are going to get some return for this? And hence the argument, it is inevitably cast that universities ought to contribute to the productivity and creativity of the economy. And that's all very well. I mean, it is, as a taxpayer, you certainly want to feel that your money is in fact being spent on something which is worthwhile. But it does inevitably lead to the assumption that the government articulates what that agenda for post-secondary education is, and the institutions are to follow that government lead. And, of course, the agenda, as the government sets it out, is largely utilitarian. And again, to take the terms from that discussion paper, we have the opportunity to modernize our post-secondary education system that would make it more relevant, more flexible, more beneficial to Ontario students. It will grow the economy, and et cetera, et cetera. There's a vision statement of the MTCU document, which reads, the vision presented by our government is Ontario's colleges and universities will drive creativity, innovation, knowledge, and community engagement through teaching and research. They will put students first by providing the best possible learning experience for all students in an affordable and financially sustainable way, ensuring high quality and globally competitive outcomes for students and Ontario's creative economy. The literally bottom line is the contribution to the creative economy. I'm not against a creative and flourishing economy, but this vision of Ontario higher education has really focused essentially at its core on economic growth is one which, coming as I do from a very different institution, at least at the present time, I have to throw up my hand and say, whoa, wait a second, aren't there some other issues that we need to consider as well? In contrast to this vision of higher education, we do prefer one which is uses two words not found in that vision statement from the MTCU, truth and freedom. And students have gone on to a wide variety of careers, but we believe that several years of liberal arts education in an institution which does have a distinctive and clearly articulated vision of its own has been extraordinarily helpful to them as they develop as mature and responsible adults. So clearly the small private college or institution is not the answer to all of the issues facing the Ontario post-secondary educational institutions. However, I think we do raise some questions about the nature and the value of education, the nature of diversity, the nature of what we do as institutions, which need to be addressed. So thank you very much for your attention.
Well, thank you very much to all three speakers for a very useful talks. We would now like to begin the discussion. And before throwing it open for questions from the floor, and we have two microphones that I would ask you to use, I would like to ask one question to all three panelists. And this is one that challenges the premise of perhaps the symposium, that Ontario needs more universities, or at least universities that can accommodate more students. Many graduates we hear from the public media accounts have difficulty finding jobs where they use their university training. However, one hears a loud refrain about the looming shortage of skilled tradespeople, plumbers, carpenters, etc. Unlike Europe, North Americans seem to look down on people who get their hands dirty. Yet these positions pay well, and I would argue that these people have very fulfilling lives. One colleague suggested the problem could be solved by awarding degrees such as Bachelor of Science in Plumbing. Should Ontario's academic and political leaders work to change attitudes of our fellow citizens, rather than urging the construction of expensive additional university infrastructure? Perhaps you'd like to comment. David, shall we start with you?
Well, thank you. William gave me a little heads up last week that, this might come up. So can I ask, first of all, is it possible to put my slides back up? I have a couple of bits of data that might help this. Let me say, in general, the answer to this question from my perspective is we need all those people. And we do need plumbers. We do need drywallers. We do need people who are in construction trades, other trades. We also need the people who come out of universities, who come out of other kinds of college programs. When we're talking about 50,000 or 75,000 more students going to university, all of us would recognize that if they all became plumbers instead, we'd have a problem on that side of the labor market. So you're really going to need a whole range of professions. Young people come out into the labor force, particularly in the last 4 years, have graduated into one of the most brutal labor markets we've seen in a very, very long time. But what the data show is quite consistently young people who go on to higher education do better than young people who don't. So you see very clearly there this sort of gap between the unemployment rate of young people with no post-secondary education versus the ones who've completed either a university degree or some sort of college program. If we focus specifically on the university students, we actually measure every year whether students get jobs after they attend university. And you can find these data by program. These are our employment rates for students who went out looking for jobs after they graduated from university. And they're ranked by program there. And you see the red bar there is the average for all university students. It's more than 90%. So more than 90% of university students who graduate and look for a job get one. Now, you might think, oh, yeah, but what about the ones who study humanities and social sciences? Well, those are actually the two green bars there. Okay, humanities and social sciences do pretty much about the same as the average for the university as a whole. The programs on the far right there are the low end. Surprisingly, it's the physics students who, for whatever reason, seem to do worse than physics and biology do worse than humanities and social science. I don't read anything into that for a long term, but that's that end of the spectrum. And then you say, well, maybe the university students have got jobs, but they're all working at Starbucks. Even that's not really so. These pie charts here show whether the student says that they're employment had some, either a close relationship or at least some relationship to what they studied in university. And the first one is for students 6 months after graduation. You see about a quarter of them say it had nothing to do with what they did. And once time passes, about 2 years after graduation, you see about a sixth of them say that their employment doesn't have anything to do with what they studied in school. All right, so we could reasonably focus on that one-sixth and say, gee, couldn't they have done better? Is there something that we didn't do well with those students? But I think overall the data here would show that a young person who chooses university because that's what they are interested in and it's what leads them to the kind of field that they want to study, most of those students over time are doing better with what they're doing than if they hadn't attended at all. We could look at more data for with respect to students who study in the trade, because obviously there's demand for that as well. But I think the data would tend to show we need all types of these things. And we're not doing a bad job of matching people with the workforce that actually exists for them.
Keith or Craig?
Well, I don't know if anyone's challenged or asked, is the assumption, do we need 70% post-secondary education attainment? I don't think anyone's asked that question. Maybe we do, given the fact that we're dealing with a knowledge economy and we need people who are well-educated to deal in that new reality. But then the question is, if that's the case, what kind of knowledge do they need? And what you get from government is ideas that it has to be very prescribed, whether in the sciences or on technology or innovation. And I'm not convinced that that necessarily is going to prepare them well enough for the new knowledge economy. So I think those are questions that need to be asked. We just accept that assumption that's being put out by the government, and I don't think we actually push back and ask, do we need 70%? And if we do, in what mixture do we need it?
Keith?
I think the question is not just do we need 70% of the students attaining university degrees. Can 70% of the population attain university degrees? Degrees which require the kind of rigor and the kind of content normally associated with the university degree, or does it necessarily involve a redefinition of what a university degree means so that 70% can attain them? I don't think that is necessarily the case that 70% are needed. But does everybody need some of the background given by higher education? And the answer would be yes. And again, obviously, special pleading here, I'd argue that the example of my own institution is that, in fact, even people who have no intention going on to receive degrees, who are clearly intending to go off into some form of trade, do benefit by one or two or more years of liberal education, which makes them much better at what they do, not because they're learning plumbing, but because they're learning critical reasoning skills, which are of enormous value to them in any future occupation. So, no, I'm skeptical about the notion that 70% is a desirable or achievable figure.
And if I just could add, some provinces, and I know David's mentioned this in his books, provinces like BC as well as Alberta, and certainly in the States have the associate degree category, which actually might be of some value, where students do a couple years of broad liberal education, however you want to define that, before they move on to the more specific areas that they want to study, whether that's in the trades or elsewhere.
Yeah, I would just add, I actually think a lot of people in government would agree with the points that Keith and Craig just made here, which is, you know, the commitment that Premier McGinney made was that 70% of the population should attain a post-secondary credential, which not necessarily a university degree, could be a college program, could be an apprenticeship. Somewhere in our workforce, you know, roughly 70% of what we'll need in future will be jobs where people do have some sort of post-secondary education. And increasingly, what I hear people in government talking about are, you know, some of the same things we're talking about here, which is, you know, a mix of people who do something practical, but who also have critical thinking skills, communication skills, numeracy, ability to work in teams, things that are basic skills that one would expect from a liberal arts education as much from any other form of education.
Thank you very much. Perhaps we'd like to open it up to the floor, so please step up to microphone. If you could please also start by identifying yourself, that'd be appreciated. Go ahead.
I'm Deanie Van Pelt, Redeemer University College. Dr. Trick, when I was reading your book last week, I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to have a conversation with one or more of these authors and ask them what they thought the role of the private religious university might be within your landscape. And even today, when you hinted at the role of private universities, you brought up the for-profit university. But I'm thinking more, of course, about this very unique position that a few of us find ourselves in this province. How can we argue for our positioning as yes, we're private, but we're not for profit, and we're religious? How can we establish for ourselves a space in the new landscape for post-secondary education that you're describing, a defensible position? Because I think there are many in this room that can attest to the fact that we are often targets of some animosity and disrespect or disregard. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that question, and thank you for reading my book. I hope you can say that you were reading it on a beach in the Caribbean. No? Not so much. Okay. It could be a new book club. I think there's a tremendously important role that private institutions, religiously based institutions, can play. For a whole lot of historical reasons, it's not a front and center issue with provincial governments, frankly, of any party. And we can kind of go into those reasons, but I'm not predicting that they'll suddenly shift their attention in this direction. And so that's all the more reason why, you know, the premise of your question, you know, like what can you do as someone associated with that to attract the attention that the institution deserves? Think about some of the issues that I talked about in terms of quality of education. Okay? We have large number of students going through large institutions who might be asking themselves, you know, is this the right institution in terms of the quality of what they want from an education? And so that in itself, you know, is a drawing point that you can offer that perhaps others aren't offering. Second thing I would add is how hard it is if you want to attend a relatively small, relatively personal campus, how hard it is to find one of those in Ontario anymore. There are a number of institutions that used to be several thousand students that now find themselves, after the past decade, they're at 15,000 students. There are a number of institutions that were 15 or 20,000 students, and they now find themselves at 30 and 35,000 students. And we can go up the ladder. There are very few opportunities, either in the GTA or, frankly, anywhere in Ontario, for the young person who wants to have a campus that is 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 students. So there's so many things that one can offer at such a campus that are harder to offer at a large scale. And so that, too, it seems to me, is an important point here. In terms of curriculum, you know, every institution has to decide for themselves what's appropriate in terms of emphasis on knowledge, skills, values, what's the balance amongst them. So that's for each institution to decide. But quality of education and opportunity for a personal experience, it seems to me, are real drawing points for some students, and that might be the starting point for that.
Could I say a few comments? My father was a faculty member at the University of Windsor, and when he was hired in the early 60s before Vatican II, I was a young child walking across campus, and I said, Papa, you call that man father? Why does he have a dress? Where are his children? And this, of course, was a priest in those days. But the point that I'm trying to make is, unlike today, almost all of Ontario's universities have this religious background. So 50 years ago, we didn't have these secular institutions. That's not to say I want to turn the clock back by any means. But the situation we face today is a bit unique. If you look in the United States, almost all of those famous universities, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, began life as seminaries. So perhaps if we look at the broader reach of history, the role of a private sector, perhaps a religious-based institution, has always been very valuable for advanced education. And I guess the issue becomes, for some of these schools, if I understand it correctly, is accreditation of programs and courses. And we also want to make certain that this is of high quality, where people have intellectual, academic freedom, et cetera. Did either of you want to comment on things like that?
Well, the context at Nipissing, we're about 4,500, so we are probably one of the last publicly funded institutions in Ontario that are small. But the challenge is under the current funding model is we can't stay small because the gap is, as has been pointed out, is huge. Your costs increase 4 to 5% every year. Your revenue increases by 2%, and the model that the government has adopted is basically a growth model. And so we're forced by just to stay afloat and is to keep increasing, which I don't think is necessarily in our best interests. I think to survive in and to compete with the Yorks of this world, I think we need to be smaller because I think we can offer things that bigger institutions can't, but we're constrained by the funding model.
Well, obviously, we share a similar belief that the religiously based institutions, even though based on often very different denominational backgrounds, have a vital role to play. And I think in terms of funding, we do not ask for any government money. We don't want any government money. We'd be horrified at the suggestion of getting government money because it would invariably mean government control of what we taught and how we taught it. And that would utterly compromise the nature of what we are. What we would like, I think, is what you alluded to, a recognition by the MTCU that we are a legitimate part of the educational diversity of the province and deserve respect, deserve recognition, and rather than being regarded as the barely tolerated sort of marginal players of the educational system. I think what we do is, in fact, very valuable. And in fact is, as you noted, really the origin of a large number of universities essentially came out of this kind of background and went on to become something else. And whether that something else retains some of those core values, of course, is another issue. But no, I think we're an essential part of what happens in Ontario.
Yes, go ahead.
Father Robert Barringer from St. Augustine's Seminary, which is a member college of the Toronto School of Theology at the University of Toronto. I'd like to return to the theme of diversity that Dr. Cassidy raised and was just being discussed here. I think your observations about the lack of perhaps authentic diversity on so many public campuses is cogent. But thinking of your own situation, of our situation, Tyndale, there are a number of people in the room who can identify with this, I can hear the criticism, well, that's all very well, your observations about us, but what about students within your smaller communities who, for whatever reason, don't espouse or find themselves there, but they've come in at 18, they don't know what they should be looking for, sent by parents, attracted for whatever reason. Shouldn't they have the freedom, meaning, I suspect, this wide range of options to go in any direction without coercion or any sense of being cut off from possibilities. It does seem to me that the language of freedom that you use in your context, that I would certainly understand, is not this competitive movement among 1,000 options, but represents a vision of freedom that St. Paul and others have talked about and has been developed within the Christian tradition. And at the level of the public universities, I don't think that's the vision of freedom at all. It is this competitive choice among 1,000 options. So in terms of the question of diversity, quite apart from our historical background, the pressure of public institutions to avoid any sense of commitment, not only in public places, but even in private places, that seems to me to be a reality here that we also have to enunciate and take seriously.
Thank you. Did anyone wish to comment on that?
Yes, indeed. First off, I think there is a gap which I noticed, and that is public universities profess a diversity which they do not practice, and this is very disturbing because they claim to be open to a variety of viewpoints, but if you actually are acquainted with, as you are indeed, with what goes on and the reality of these institutions, it's very difficult for students, even at these professed temples of tolerance, to find toleration for their viewpoints. On the other hand, our institution makes absolutely no claim to being anything other than what we are. Students come to our institution knowing fully well what we are. We go out of our way to make it clear what we are. There's no false pretense. We offer an education from a particular perspective, and if students don't like it, they leave. We don't actually chain them on campus. They're there. They can go, and that's fine. And if a student is there and says, I don't agree with this, I mean, that's fine. You don't agree with it. Well, you will go away knowing what it is that you don't agree with, but you will be well-grounded and understand, have a good comprehension of the things with which you disagree. But I think that it is important that it be understood that institutional autonomy means the right of institutions to choose their own character and to choose who they are. And as an institution, we have, it seems to me, chosen to use our autonomy to, because we're not a church body. There is no bishop sitting on our board. No bishop appoints our board members. It's an autonomous institution which has chosen an identity which it publicly proclaims and to which it attempts to be faithful. And students come because that is what they want. And if they discover they don't like it, then they go elsewhere. And it enables us to actually have a curriculum which presents a coherent viewpoint. It isn't just courses randomly stuck together. It really does represent a coherent vision of man and creation. So I think that the challenge for public universities is to recognize the ways in which they are not, in fact, living up to their own professed mission. And I was at the University of Guelph. It was in my last year teaching there that the student council attempted to close down by refusing to recognize in any form the Campus for a Life Club. And what was very disturbing is the student council did this by a unanimous vote, and only under threat of legal action was it in fact forced to back down. So you have to ask yourself, what kind of vision of tolerance has been taught to these students? And by the way, what can you expect for the kind of tolerance 30 years down the road when the people sitting in that student council chamber become the judges and cabinet ministers of the future?
Could I challenge that a little bit, Keith? If one is at a public institution, say my own university like York or Guelph, your alma mater, I can see that there would be a bit of resistance, shall we put it delicately, to a pro-life group. Mm-hmm. But could one not argue that at an institution such as your present one, there would be reluctance, or students could feel a little trepidation of forming a group of the opposite persuasion?
Of course, because our situation is one in which we do, in fact, have a clearly enunciated institutional identity which does not rely for a penny of public support. And you come to our campus, if a student on campus wanted to create such a group, presumably they could, but it would be inconceivable because that's not why they're there. They're there for something very different. I'm not sure, it seems to me that the identity of a small institution, the attraction is that precisely it can choose to state a particular vision of life and adhere to it. The reality is we are this tiny little institution. For most students, we are not an option because financially the attraction comes from heavily subsidized public institutions whose tuition has been held down by public support, whose parents get substantial rebates of tuition from the provincial government, which have enormous inducements to go to these institutions. it seems to me that the question is, why is there, in fact, even any question as to whether legitimate political and social views are suppressed or attempted to be suppressed at publicly supported institutions? This seems to me to be a question about the nature of higher education in this province, which has to be addressed. Why is this even felt to be in some fashion reasonable?
Thank you. Next questioner, please.
Yes, my name is Justin Cooper. I'm with Christian Higher Education Canada. I have a question that's going to shift us in a little bit of a different direction, more of a structural consideration that would cut across all, you know, different forms of education, and that is, as directed, Dr. Trick, to you, first of all, what is your understanding of the global trends in higher education within which Canada, I think, will, as a minority country, need to operate? And I'm wondering specifically about the trend to a three-year BA as being the normative degree program. One thinks of the Bologna Accord, other things like this. So could you comment on the global trends as you understand them, first of all, and then secondly, the likely impact that they would have on Canada and the United States as trying to be players in that global environment?
Good. Thank you very much for that. There's so much happening worldwide that when you read about it, you quickly start to translate it back and you realize that the problems of higher education actually are experienced in almost every country that has a significant higher education system. So some of the things I said this morning by way of Ontario problems are actually problems that every jurisdiction experiences. The trend towards higher and higher participation rates, so where are we going to find enough spaces for students? And the fact that higher education, by virtue of being a service, the cost tends to grow more quickly than anyone really wants to pay for. Grows more quickly than what governments want to pay for, grows more quickly than what students want to pay for. And so every government and every jurisdiction wrestles with some of those fundamental problems. And one of the ways in which some governments have chosen to deal with them is to take a look at the length of academic programs. So, Justin, you mentioned in particular in Europe, as part of the Bologna Accord, trying to standardize around a three-year baccalaureate. The Europeans had had the most amazing set of credentials, all of which purported to do the same thing, but in some countries, your baccalaureate was actually 6 years long. In some countries, you know, the master's degree actually meant something. In other countries, it was basically an honorary thing for staying on campus for another year. So as part of trying to integrate their labor market, they said, okay, could we integrate credentials so that a credential would mean the same thing no matter which country you went to? And yes, they have settled on a model of a three-year baccalaureate and then a two-year master's program following that. If we try to translate that to Canada, well, we've had three-year degrees in Ontario for a very long time, and even though they aren't heavily advertised, they still exist and lots of students still take them. The Americans never adopted that model. So the question for us is, you know, to what extent are we affected by the European set of credentials versus to what extent are we actually more integrated with the United States labor market and heavily influenced by what the Americans think is an appropriate length of a degree. And that debate, I think, goes on within a number of our universities. The government has... as you know from their discussion paper last summer, tried to encourage the idea of three-year degrees, but they were very, I'll say, not specific about what those degrees should mean or what they meant in terms of students then going on to other programs. So I couldn't try to predict what they are likely to do as a result of that conversation. But if I express a personal opinion here, there are lots of students for which a three-year baccalaureate degree followed by a year of professional training might be better than a four-year baccalaureate degree. So 3 years of learning basic critical skills that one learns in a liberal arts education, followed by 1 year at a university or 1 year at a college that is of a more practical element, you know, might be much more preparation for those students than taking the fourth year of a BA, which often is preparation for graduate school or something along those lines. So having some flexibility in models, you know, might be attractive for students. Whether government lands on that spot, whether any particular set of institutions land on that, I don't know, but I'll express that as a personal opinion.
If I could just chime in, having come from another jurisdiction in Manitoba, we had three-year degrees and as well four-year honors degrees, and there was a clear differentiation between the two. When I came to Ontario, I was kind of shocked at how debased the honors degree was in Ontario. And I don't think we're slowly moving back to what I think should be an honors degree. So I think I would agree with David. I think there's a good place for a three-year degree, but again, I think the problem what's happened in Ontario from my perspective as a former outsider is that changes have largely been driven by money, that the universities of Ontario move increasingly to honors degrees because that's where they could get the cash to fund their programming. Unless that changes, I don't see they're going to move away from that. The other problem with three-year degrees, and I think unless the U.S. embraces, which I don't think is going to happen, I think we are going to predominantly have four-year degrees because students going on from three-year degrees in Canada to the U.S., the U.S. doesn't know what to make of them, in terms of graduate programming. It's not a two-year associate. It's not a four-year degree, which they understand. It's somewhere in lost in no man's land, and I think students are challenged on that. So from my perspective, unless the funding model changes significantly, that then we can have true honors degrees, then I think we're stuck with what we got.
I think the crucial component here is what is happening before university in the K-12 educational system. And a three-year degree would make perfect sense if students entered university with a really good secondary education. I think it would be safe to say that they do not enter university with a large number of the skills which they should reasonably be expected to have. And that a four-year degree, I mean, to put it with brutal frankness, essentially you're spending some time in remedial education and you need 4 years to, in fact, teach skills which you could otherwise assume that they would have and could successfully complete the three-year degree. This focuses the session is obviously not on high school education, but I think we all recognize that looming in the background of everything we do is what do the students coming into our institutions actually know and what can they actually do? And not necessarily to say that the old system of Ontario of having a grade 13 of an OAC year was necessarily always as good as it advertised, but I think did make a real difference in terms of student level of preparation.
Just go ahead.
Very quick hot pursuit, and that is, I appreciate the responses, but I think the burden of my question is something like this. Is China adopting the three-year BA? Is India adopting the three-year BA? If they are, and if that's where Africa and Latin America are going, I don't think we're going to have an opportunity to debate this matter. I think it'll be decided elsewhere. That's really the burden, I think, of my question. I'm not sure that we get to set the terms necessarily in a global environment, looking forward 10 or 15 years.
Could it be that perhaps China does not have the goal immediately to have 70% of its students go to university or some academic credentialing? I frequently get graduate students from China, and the competition there for spots is very severe. So maybe that's part of the problem, that a three-year degree from China will be more demanding than some of our three-year degrees. I don't know. Did any of you wish to add comments?
I'm wondering if India is going to be the big driver, because they are adding at an astonishing rate new universities every year. But I'm not sure whether they're falling down on three-year degrees or on four-year degrees. I don't know at this point.
Justin, I have to say I don't know the answer to your question either, so that's the thing that's well worth looking up. Thank you.
Hi, Rick Cunningham from Tyndale. And I guess when I think of the possibilities for academic reform, my mind starts turning around what we do in the classrooms right now. And so very interested in the rethinking that you had listed and wondering if you do have, I haven't read your book, so maybe they're in there. But maybe any thinking around what it would be to start measuring learning and delineating what are the actual outcomes that we want with students, and then tying that to any new models of instruction that you may be aware of that is taking place in classrooms now.
Let me just say that the general premise here is to know very clearly what your learning objectives are, to assess the students coming in the door to see how close they are to those learning objectives, and then to see as they go out the door what value you've added as a higher education institution over whatever period of time they've been with you. The premise itself is fairly straightforward and one that one might see in a whole lot of other settings other than in higher education. The particular book, and Craig, you mentioned it, Academically Adrift, came out in the United States 2 years ago, looked at a group of students and applied to them something called the Collegiate Learning Assessment, which was a test of generic skills. So communication skills, critical thinking skills, ability to write, ability to comprehend what you've read. Basic skills that any university education would purport to teach. And they looked at students 2 years after they'd entered, and they looked at students 4 years after they'd entered, and a very significant share of those students, after 4 years, 36% of the students didn't show any improvement over the day they walked in the door of the university. And these were, now it wasn't a huge sample, it was about 2,400 students representing a number of different types of universities. But, you know, think of that as a basic instrument that one might use to teach certain kinds of learning in the university environment. Professions very commonly have an exit exam or an entry to that profession exam, which would be another example of the kind of things that you might focus on. So to enter, say, law or engineering or nursing, you know for sure whether you've taught the subject because the students either do or do not pass the entrance exams for those professions. Creating the proper instrument for whatever you're trying to teach is clearly one hurdle here, and I don't minimize the size of that hurdle. But once you're focusing on, you know, what is the student learning as opposed to simply time spent on task, you have the chance then to liberate yourself from a typical classroom setting. You have a chance to assign students opportunities to learn on their own. Problem-based learning can be part of that. Experiential learning can be part of that. A whole lot of learning opportunities outside the classroom become possible because what you're measuring is what they actually do learn. So now let me ask, does that help with your question? I have the blessing of only teaching one class, so I have a very, very small sample size from which personally to draw on. But, you know, when we started the University of Guelph-Humber, so University of Guelph's campus at Humber College, one of the premises was that every student should go out the door after 4 years having completed all the learning that they should have for a university degree and also all the learning they should have for a two-year college program. And it was fully integrated. So in other words, we didn't teach 2 years of college courses and then teach 2 years of university courses. Every course had to be restructured from scratch based on specific learning objectives that were partly, if you like, academic and partly experiential and hands-on. You know, think of that as a way of taking 6 years, what would normally take 6 years of study, bringing them into four by focusing on what the student actually has to learn. You know, that would be the model that I was most closely associated with that I think draws on some of this premise.
One of the teaching techniques that is frequently talked about, the innovations, is online learning. And this has been discussed, I think, every university, including my own. And a number of the faculty, they say, online learning is cheap if it is done badly. It's expensive if you do it well. And so the previous questioner asked about teaching innovation and pedagogy. Some of you alluded to that. Did you want to comment on that issue?
Well, I know Nipissing's going big time into it, and for some reason people above me think that's going to be the salvation of the institution, but I'm not convinced, and I think you're right on that point. If you're going to do it well, it's going to cost more money than the traditional method of lecturing in the classroom. But I think where online technology or, you know, mediated technology in the classroom can be most helpful, I think, and I don't know if I have anyone in my faculty, but it does intrigue me that is what they call the flipped classroom, where You can actually then simulate maybe an Oxbridge model where you become the tutor as opposed to the lecturer. And then all the content is delivered through online, and then what you meet face-to-face are in seminars or small groups in which you can then do some problem solving or talk about the big issues involved in that. Those, to me, I think are quite exciting and actually can rejuvenate the classroom in some significant ways. But again, I think it requires good technology. It requires individuals that are savvy with it and feel comfortable with it and so forth. But those would be examples that I would look to.
Keith?
I think it can be a very helpful supplement to education conventionally carried on. I don't think it's a replacement, and I certainly agree with the point. Certainly what we learned at Guelph was that it was not something you could do cheaply. It involved a huge expenditure of effort to get a good online course. One thing that, which very much strikes me from my own current experience, though, is that education really does necessarily involve direct human contact in a classroom with other people, because the process of not being mediated electronically with other people, dealing with them face-to-face, creating a community of learners sitting in a room is essentially irreplaceable. At least some part of education has to have that experience of a truly human kind of interaction. And I know that there are degrees which you can get in which you never actually sit in a room with another human being, and there certainly you can learn things, and there is value to that education. I'm not saying it's valueless, but I think there's something of deep significance that's lost when you don't have that experience of having to deal with other people as people in working out ideas or going out and having a coffee or, depending on where you are, a beer after the class.
David, did you have anything you wish to add?
I'll just say I think the best evaluation studies from the United States actually confirm much of what you just said. What they show is that a good quality online course can produce just as much learning as a good quality classroom course, but what's even better is when you combine the two. So some of the learning takes place online, some of it is supplemented by the professor in the classroom. The studies also show this, the one sort of shortcoming of online learning in particular is for students who aren't terribly well prepared academically to start with. If you're not terribly well prepared academically and someone sits you in your parents' basement and says, here, take a course online, those are the students least likely to complete. And if they do complete, they're the least likely to have the quality of learning that they would have in a classroom.
Go ahead.
Hello, I'm Christina Belcher from Redeemer University College. I'd just like a couple of points that I think I've heard you say, and then maybe one query. When I listen to this, I seem to think that there's more of a system world, life world crisis going on, in that the larger universities with the money crunch are sort of being pressured into educating craniums on sticks and getting through, whereas the smaller universities appear to have the time, perhaps, and maybe the numbers to be able to think about the life world system of the students as they go through the university. But I think the real question is, what about the innovation in the university? Do we actually have universities that are structured systemically to allow innovation to be able to grade the type of learning that you are talking about, David, in your book? And I would just like to get a grip on whether the university structure and system world would have to actually change somewhat for us to be able to have more authentic learning that is going to create a particular type of citizen rather than just an educated head. I'm just interested in how those questions overlap.
Let me just make sure I have the right question here. The question is, could the existing large public universities, do they have the wherewithal internally to change in order to change how they teach, to adopt more innovative teaching methods? Is that really?
Either the large or the small universities.
Okay. Being an optimist by nature, and also having studied a little bit about this, The short answer to your question, I think, is yes, they do have that potential. But let's think about sort of, you know, how do you get from A to B. Think about the pressures I talked about on the university. Okay, so there's financial pressure, plus every year we want them to take in more students. And then thirdly, and what I think is maybe the most pertinent thing here, is we want universities to be the producers of the great research that will reinvigorate our economy. Okay? Governments layered that mission onto university, particularly starting in the late 1990s. So we've had about 15 years of this. Governments, particularly the federal government, to some extent provincial, holding out large pots of money, saying, okay, compete for this money, and there are potentially tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of dollars that your university can get from the Canada Foundation for Innovation, from the three granting councils, other big federal government programs, and provincial as well. So there's enormous pressure on every faculty member to dress up his or her research resume to show that he or she was doing the caliber of research that was competitive at that level. So huge pressures on people to spend more time doing research and do better research. Well, come back to my point. You know, faculty members have 24 hours in the day like everybody else. Something had to give, and I think a lot of what gave was the attention that people might otherwise have liked to devote it to undergraduate teaching. So we roll forward to current day. What do you do? Well, think about those pressures, and maybe it's time to shift the pressure a bit and say, look, you know, we really not mandatory for every single faculty member to try to become a world-caliber researcher if their interests, if their abilities, if their capacity, and if what we need is better teaching. And so you shift that balance within the university. You give innovation money, some startup money for some new ways of teaching. You recognize that not every single one of those ways is going to succeed, and so some of that money, well, you might have to then do other kinds of innovation instead. My observation is there are lots of good people within the university who would like to be better teachers and who would like to do different things in the classroom. But you have to take off some of that pressure that says, oh, gee, I want to see six new journal articles every year. Because you know, that's some of the balance. And it's not the faculty members' fault. It's not even the university's fault. It's, you know, when we as a public, when governments on behalf of the public put those pressures on universities, they respond to those pressures. And so we have to actually be articulate about, you know, for the money that we're providing, what do we actually expect the university to do, and then work together with them in order to make those things happen.
Did any of you others want to comment?
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with David, although I do think there's considerable amount of inertia in universities. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because you're not changing at every whim of government and things like that. But it means it's a big ship that takes a long time to turn it around. And I think David's right that there is lots of pressure, and that for a faculty member, and I was in that position once as well, where, you know, you're looking towards tenure and promotion, and so you're focusing on your research, that it's easy just to continue to deliver the same lectures you did last year, maybe tweak them a little bit, but not do anything substantially different. I think where my thinking has changed was when I actually taught a couple years ago and I got my student evaluations back and realized I'm not as good as I thought I was. And I thought Ontario students were more discriminating than students from Manitoba, but at any rate, it made me think that maybe it's time to reinvent what I do. And so that's why I'm thinking about, if I actually do ever go back to the classroom, thinking about ideas of blended learning or flipping the classroom, which can actually both invigorate the classroom as well as the instructor. But I think the other thing that we can do as deans in that is take away the risk, because they are risky, because it, you know, it might prove to be completely unsuccessful, and as a young faculty member, you don't want to take those kinds of risks that might in some ways jeopardize your tenure or your promotion.
Just in terms of the last comment about the innate conservatism of higher education, even the most radical professor turns out to be deeply conservative when its own courses often are being asked to be radically changed. Somebody once said that changing a university curriculum is like moving a graveyard, and there is something of that. I think one of the questions, though, is how does the faculty member identify themselves? Do they see themselves primarily as teachers, or do they see themselves primarily as biologists or historians or whatever? Because if your primary thought is, I'm a person in this profession, in this discipline, and that's my group to which I'm oriented, the applause that I seek is from fellow statisticians or biologists or physicists or whatever, or is my primary group to whom I'm attuned my colleagues and my students? And this is a major problem. I don't know the answer, because at a large research institution, it's very clear that the pressure is you are to identify that your anonymous reviewer at NSERC or SSHRC is the person you're really trying to appeal to and to whom you're orienting your activities. And the advantage of smaller institutions, other institutions, is you can say, no, look, yes, you may be a philosopher, but you're a philosopher who teaches philosophy. And it'd be nice if you do publishing, and that's good, and we want you to keep up in your field. But at the end of the day, that is not who you primarily are. You are primarily the person in the classroom. Obviously, there has to be a research component for good teaching, but it's really a question, at the end of the day, who are you? Are you a teacher? And if you think that, then I think you're much more open to taking those kind of risks of changing your style.
And just to add to that, I think that's a good point, that, you know, if you primarily consider yourself as a biologist or a geographer, then it restricts you from exploring interdisciplinary types of teaching experiences, which can be very, very valuable both for yourself as a teacher as well as for the students. And increasingly, as we hear from various books and reports, is that increasingly students need to understand how to view things from a multiple of perspectives.
Go ahead.
I apologize.
I didn't see you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sharon Ranson. I'm on the Chancellor Circle here at Tyndale. I'm also on the advisory board for Queen's Business School and a part-time professor, as you described, in the Queen's graduate business program as well. So come at it from a number of different ways. And I am an accountant by training, so my question is actually more practical in nature and certainly from the financial point of view. One of the big problems facing governments is deficits and huge issues in terms of actually funding anything, including education. And two of the big issues, to me, from a funding point of view, are healthcare and personal debt levels. So to me, part of our issue as a society is we're not actually educating people on personal health and or personal debt, which is becoming increasingly important. So two questions. One is, where is the place to be teaching those practical life skills to then help us as a society? I mean, it's great to have all the higher level of learning, but if we can't actually solve those basic needs, we won't have any money left for education. And secondly, you know, I sit at the table in terms of a number of educational institutions, and the money is always, always an issue. So it's impossible to say we'll educate if we can't fund it. So first of all, where are we going to teach those life skills if they're not being taught at high school, or where are we teaching them? And secondly, where's the money going to come from to fund higher education going forward?
Who would like to start?
Oh, it's always about money. That's the problem. Certainly from my experiences moving into administration is that dominates every aspect of higher education. So you wish it wasn't that. You wish you could talk about the bigger issues and, you know, the broader issues, but it always comes down to money. How are you going to fund programs? How are you going to pay faculty and so forth? So I would think in small, like, I have no problem if you had a program where you prescribed, you know, business 101. I think that's a valuable thing. And I've often thought perhaps, certainly on the business side, you know, a 2+2 program where students do a couple years in arts and science of whatever interests them and then move into a business program, that is probably more valuable because they have that broader thinking then as well as the more detailed professional studies. In terms of when it should be taught young, I would think. Sooner the better, at ages six, seven, you know, grades six and seven, they should be taught about health and the value of exercise and so forth, and the value of using your money wisely. So, but that doesn't answer your question, I don't think.
So, who else? Go ahead.
Let me, if I could, I'll just say a word about the sort of general financial problem here. And for my sins, I spent 12 years working in the Provincial Ministry of Finance. So I had a little bit of up close and personal view of exactly the issues you described. Seems to me that in higher education and the public sector in general, you know, we have sort of two basic strategies that are going to be the best answers to your question. They're not great answers, but they're the best ones we're going to have. One is when we provide public services, we have to provide them with a view to what can people actually afford. And in some cases, that's going to mean changing, in our case, the university or the college or whatever we're talking about, changing the organization in order to focus our resources on the things that the public actually needs from us, which may or may not be exactly what we would like to provide. And so there's that obligation on the institutions themselves. On the public, we have, and all of us are susceptible to this, a desire to have excellent first-rate public services, but not necessary to pay the taxes for them. And one of the most fundamental public finance issues of our generation, I think, is going to be, are we going to continue forever with the idea that the best government is the government that never raises taxes, no matter how pressing the public need? And everyone will have a view on that, but unless there's more revenue coming on that side, all of the answer has to be found by internal efficiencies within public sector organizations. And having worked in them and worked with them for a very long period of time, you know, I think the easy stuff has been done there. And if there's going to be more efficiency to be found, it's going to be much, much harder than it has been in the past.
My apology for not seeing you right away. I don't know which of you gentlemen was first. Do you recall? Okay, go ahead.
Well, thank you all for your presentations. I'm Hubert Kreisman from Redeemer University College as well. I want to take you back to some of the points that have already been suggested and ask for your comment about this. My sense is that the province of Ontario's way of dealing with higher education is probably more monolithic than any other part in North America. That is, if you look at Western Canada, if you look at the United States, there is systemic pluralism in ways that you don't find in Ontario, especially those of us who have to deal with the NTCU. And I'm wondering if any of this rings true to you, if you see any kind of sort of breakdown or openings in that monolithic system. When I think of the following examples, some of which have come up. So, for example, we've talked about some of the financial pressures on the universities and on the government. We see a very intense debate about three-year BAs and who may grant them. And the Council of Ontario Universities is interacting very intensively with MTCU about the role of the community colleges and their ability to grant degrees, both bachelor's and master's. There's also a profound difference between what AUCC presidents have been talking about and the new narrative and the importance of personally meaningful undergraduate education as opposed to the kinds of visions for sort of practical job-oriented training, for example, that you see in the Drummond report. You see the growing tension between research and teaching emphases that we've just heard about. And then lots of questions about the role of private colleges and universities, including faith-based, but also other for-profit colleges and universities. Do you foresee any loosening of the uniformity in Ontario, at least from the perspective of government and that sort of thing? Is there a time and an opportunity here for letting a thousand flowers bloom or something like that?
Could you make the response, maybe one of you, rather quickly? I know it's an important question, but I'm sorry, we're running out of time.
From my perspective, I would probably say no, because I don't think any government has the political will to do it. If they do, then yes. And I certainly would think an institution like mine, which under its original mandate was to be undergraduate and then has now been allowed to offer graduate programs, and we're doing them as well, and I'm as guilty as the next person in developing them. But I'm wondering if we would have been better served if we remained as a primarily or as an undergraduate institution where our focus is solely on that. But unless some government has the political will to do it, I just don't see how it's going to happen. And the only ones I think might get it are things like Sheridan College, some of the larger colleges. But I'm not sure what form that's going to take. Maybe Dave could.
Could I ask you to hold it a little bit? I don't know if we have time for two more questions. Could I take yours, sir, please?
Thank you. Thank you very much. We've been talking about higher education. Our focus has been, and the question was raised over here, and the response from Craig was, well, maybe that should be done at the grade six level, which raises the question, education in general, and to what extent are the elementary and secondary schools need to be part of this solution that we're looking for. We have these students that are going to school for 13-odd years. The question is, what do they know when they come out of it? And if I'm hearing you correctly, they don't seem to be as well prepared for university as they used to be. So what is going on here? Now, if the issues here are financial literacy and health and phys ed, I think the problem could be solved very quickly. And I'm going to throw a bomb in the room, and you can see what you want to do with it. Right now, we do EQA testing in Ontario, a highly expensive program where we're testing for literacy, language literacy, and mathematics. And what at grade 3, at grade 6, and at grade 9 and 10. And it's what we value, we test for. Why we got a problem with physical fitness? Because we don't test for it. That's why. Because we don't value it as a course when we hold these students in a custodial way for 13 years. Why are they not know anything about financial literacy? Because our math is being taught at such a level that we've got increased levels of math phobia. I challenge any one of you here to take the grade 10 math test and see how you do. Because many of the things that are being asked there are not the things that we use later on in our lives. I'm a dinosaur from a former era. I was taught the old math that was in effect before Sputnik was launched. I knew how to amortize house mortgages at grade 8 by hand without a calculator. I was financially literate at grade 8.
Thank you very much. We really are running out of time. Do you have something very fast? Go ahead. Can you have 30 seconds to pose your questions, please?
Well, I think a couple of things we need to think about. The universities are running out of money. Britain has come up with an interesting solution. They more than doubled university fees. There were cries that disaster would descend, that nobody would come to university again. The results have just come in. In the first year when they more than doubled university fees, the enrollment stayed the same. So perhaps one solution is drastic increases in university fees. The other thing is, that I just wanted to comment on, was what do students think? Now, in a sense, it doesn't matter because what do they know, as Dr. Cassidy pointed out. But I think it is interesting that, according to the McLean survey of student satisfaction, big universities like York, where I also teach, are bumping along the bottom in terms of student satisfaction, whereas small places like Tyndale and Redeemer and Trinity Western and St. Francis Xavier, one of the few public institutions that rates near the top, are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 out of 45. A lot of the public universities won't even participate in this survey because they know how disastrously they'll do. So I'm just wondering what it is about these small universities that seems to generate so much student satisfaction. Maybe there's not time to answer, but it's worth thinking about.
Maybe I could go to the principal of our smallest college. Keith, would you like to give a quick response to that?
No, I appreciate that. I think it is the level of personal engagement is absolutely critical. It doesn't have to disappear at larger institutions, but it would have to be consciously created. And I think small institutions, in part because generally they have a real focus, there's also a sense of students a commitment to an actual enterprise, to a sense of belonging to an entity which has a purpose and gives them a sense of identity of where they are.
Thank you very much. At this point, the schedule calls for the moderator to sum things up in 2 minutes. And I guess that means we have posed all the relevant questions and come up with solutions. Of course, today's solution was useful in raising some of the challenges facing higher education in Ontario. And these same challenges are facing institutions all across North America and Europe. Any solution, has been pointed out even in 1820, is not going to be unique nor to remain static. We have heard this morning about a number of the innovative ideas about the role of smaller institutions and those that are private. Ontario students will undoubtedly benefit from having a range of choices. Toronto is blessed with 3 large institutions, Toronto, Ryerson, and York. The dramatic recent expansion of Tyndale University College and Seminary complements the programs offered by those large institutions. Tyndale is increasing the competition, but a greater range of educational opportunities can only benefit all of our students from Ontario, Canada, and the world. Academic reform will continue as it always has. It has been a privilege moderating this session. Thank you very much to Stephanie for organizing it. Thank you for Tyndale for hosting it.
Thank you very much. Well, our morning has already flown by today, and it seems to indicate that we will need to organize another session. So I encourage you to share with me your questions or topics for another event that we hope to organize very soon. We've been presented with a lot of intriguing issues that surround academic reform, some of which we are all dealing with right now and others that we're not yet ready to engage with. But I hope each one of you can take back some of these ideas and generate a very stimulating conversation with your colleagues and other neighboring institutions and perhaps begin to explore some of these issues together. I'd like to really thank our panelists and our moderator for putting us through such an interesting way to begin the morning together. Let's show them our appreciation. I'd also like to share our appreciation for our sponsor, Grant Thornton, if those representatives would like to stand up. Derek Williams, Lindsay McIntyre, and Nanette Bechet, who have expressed their interest and commitment in supporting this wonderful event, and without them, this would not have been possible. Thank you very much. I hope that if I can be so bold as to inspire you to perhaps be our sponsor for future similar events. Anyway, thank you so much for coming. This morning has been taped so that for those who wish to revisit it, it will be, I think, on our Tyndale website as a podcast for you to review any of the comments. So thank you very much, and I hope all of you have a wonderful day.